It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we're talking about the Pope's comments today on gay Catholics. We'll also talk about how unlimited vacation time could boost our productivity at work.
First, we have NPR's ombudsman with us on the line to answer the question, does NPR have a regional bias? Well, some people have said NPR should relocate its headquarters to the Midwest, like St. Louis, for example, or even as far west as Denver to widen its perspective.
The same critics say NPR has a regional bias, a coastal bias. They only cover stories on the coasts. Well, being in the Midwest ourselves, we're very interested in this discussion.
And so we have NPR's ombudsman. I practiced this word five times. Ombudsman Edward Schumacher Matos, and he's here to talk about NPR's regional coverage with us now.
And we also want to hear from you on this. Do you think NPR has a coastal bias? Why or why not? Do you think NPR should move its headquarters to the Midwest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Edward Schumacher Matos, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
Glad you could join us. Now, you looked at a lot of NPR coverage over the last few years to determine whether or not there is this regional bias. Why did you decide to tackle this?
You know, we get more complaints about that than probably any other subject. In terms of, you know, just steady complaints. It's like, you know, one or two come in every day. And so I finally decided, you know, how do you prove this? How do you show that? So we managed to get the library to participate in a big study, and my news assistant and a revolving number of interns. It took us a long time to put all those numbers together, but I thought it was kind of revealing what it showed.
All right, tell us what it showed.
Well, you know, it's a judgment call in many senses, right? I mean, is it clearly there's more stories that come from the two coasts. But there's a greater dispersal of mentions, significant mentions, significant stories or interviews with people in every state in the country. I mean, more than I actually expected to find, if you want to know the truth, and I think that more than many listeners realize. But that said, you know, there is a heavy preponderance of Washington stories, especially.
But you do have a reason for that, right? There might be some reason that you're covering the coasts.
You know, that's curious. You know, after I did this, we had a lot of people come back and argue and say, hey, wait a minute. Of course there's more Washington stuff, and there should be more Washington stuff because that's where you have the most the news that affects all of Americans at the same time. But the issue is not just what stories you cover, but who you interview in common stories. If you're doing a healthcare story, should you interview somebody from Wisconsin or Kansas or the state of Washington in that story and not just have voices that come from the two coasts?
Let's talk about the mission a little bit. How does this question of where the stories are coming from fit into what y'all are trying to do at NPR?
Well, you know, that's a very good question because the mission is indeed to be national. It's called National Public Radio, and it's designed to serve all Americans. And there is a goal, a stated goal inside NPR, and I think it's genuinely felt, to sound like America. And that sounding like America means in terms of gender, in terms of accents, in terms of race and ethnicity, and in terms of, you know, where people come regionally. And it's so clear when you hear accents, you know, that come from Louisiana or Wisconsin or other parts of the Midwest or up in Maine. You know, it gives you a feeling that, gee, we are part of this big nation. And we hear ourselves on the radio makes us feel closer to that.
Well, there might be a couple of prongs to that. I suppose you could get someone who is a voice on the ground, a citizen from a state that's not on the coast, or you could get an expert from there. So how did you tally that as you were looking at the coverage?
You know, we looked at just that kind of a thing. And, you know, you're saying that about the expert is a good one because so often the national media, NPR included, sort of goes to the usual suspects who come from the Washington think tanks or advocacy groups. Or they come from Harvard or Cambridge or MIT. You know, maybe you get somebody from Berkeley thrown in there. And a little bit from a few select other places in the country, Stanford or Los Angeles. But not enough who are experts who are out there in the great heartland, and there's so many who are equally qualified. You can understand it, right? Programmers are hustling. They're trying to find somebody to speak on the air, to speak on some issue. And you go to who you know, and who knows how to answer the questions on the air. But that's in doing so, you're restricting your universe, and you're missing some very good and very interesting and important people.
Well, I know one of the ways that you cover the states is you come to places like us, Wisconsin.
Right.
Public Radio will hear our own Sean Johnson or Chuck Kornbach.
Right.
Filing reports on there. Is that something that NPR seems to want to do more of?
Well, there has always been an effort to try to do more of that, and I think that's a continuing effort. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, the board of NPR is in fact controlled by the member stations. NPR is here to serve the member stations. And so there's always been a tension between how much it uses the staff from the member stations versus the national staff that work for NPR itself. I think that we're going to see even more use of member station staff for lots of reasons. One, I think the quality, the training, the sophistication, the production values of stations across the country just continue to go up, and it's equal to what you find by NPR itself. And clearly, you know, for you guys, I mean, you guys are national producers and you know, a national powerhouse in your own right. But also there's the, you know, there's going to just be a cost pressure on NPR that says, you know, we just have to be smarter and use the resources that we all have amongst us.
Were there surprises here for you? I mean, there are moments where you stopped and said, you know what? They are right. We are not putting enough stories or experts out of the state. We need to get on that stick.
Yeah. No, there were some surprises. I mean, one of the biggest surprises for me was how Texas did. I mean, Texas being such a large state, you know, our second largest state in terms of population, and you know, a state that's a protagonist in so many debates that we have in the country, actually had a relatively low number of stories given the size of its population.
Well, and that leads into maybe another discussion. I think I've seen some criticism along these lines. The coastal states that people perceive the bias in tend to be more liberal states as well. The internal states, the states like Texas that get less coverage, more conservative. Does this going to the locals give a political bias as well as a regional bias?
You know, that's a great question. When I say that NPR has to sound like America, one of the diversity goals of NPR is also ideological diversity. I don't find the ideological bias that people, particularly on the right, claim. As a matter of fact, I get more complaints from the left now than I get from the right. But I just don't see it. I mean, I can see how you can make that a jump from if the stories are mostly coastal based, then it must be more biased liberally. But it just hasn't followed in all my research to now.
What about the shaping of American culture? You know, there are big art scenes in New York. There's Hollywood in California. And those tend to be the places that get talked about. We've got a lot of artists out here, you know, in the heartland of the country and lots of other places that maybe don't get that spotlight shined on them and maybe might not get the attention because of that. Is that something that you look at as well?
You are totally right. I mean, I heard about the Oshkosh air show as I was listening to your newscast, and I thought, oh gosh, I want to go out there. I want to see that myself. There is, for example, something I didn't know, that, you know, there are more women architects in Mississippi in relative terms than there are in any state in the country. Well, who knew that? You know, when you talk of gender issues and you talk of so many things like that, you know, there's a lot going on out in the country that gets lost by just focusing on the two coasts.
We're talking to Edward Schumacher-Matos. He's the ombudsman for NPR. Talking about what some people call NPR's regional bias. Their main headquarters are on the East Coast and the West Coast, and is the Midwest, is the South, are they being left out?
And we're taking your calls next. What do you think? How do you hear NPR? Do you hear a bias in coastal coverage? Why or why not? And what do you think about NPR moving its headquarters? Not that it's going to happen, but what do you think? Should they move to Wisconsin? Should they move to Iowa? Should they move to Colorado? Let us know what you think. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up at 6 o'clock, To the Best of Our Knowledge takes a look at airports, and Alain de Botton talks about the week he spent as Heathrow's airport's first writer in residence. That's coming up at 6 o'clock on To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Here's a look at some of the latest news with WPR reporter Kristen Durst.
When it comes to the issue of gay priests, Pope Francis asks, who am I to judge? He told reporters today, quote, we shouldn't marginalize people for this. Gay leaders say the non-judgmental approach represents progress. It doesn't, however, signal a change in church policy. Catholic teaching still holds that homosexual acts are, quote, intrinsically disordered. There's a new threat facing the Great Lakes, which have already been ravaged by industrial pollution and invasive species. Scientists have discovered that there are untold millions of tiny plastic particles in the lakes, some of them visible only through a microscope. Scientists suspect the particles are abrasive microbeads used in personal care products such as facial and body washes. State Department of Justice says 10 children have been rescued and 100 suspects have been arrested in Wisconsin as part of a nationwide child sex trafficking crackdown led by the FBI. Wisconsin crackdown was done in and around Milwaukee, Madison, Wisconsin Dells, and the Fox Valley.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking to NPR Ombudsman Edward Schumacher-Matos about what some people perceive as a regional bias, a coastal bias in NPR's news coverage. Want to know what you think. Would you like to hear more Wisconsin stories, more Midwest stories in the national news, whether in NPR or elsewhere? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
And we'll take a listen to this Facebook comment now. Scott says, one thing that NPR does really well is explain regional political issues. However, in a weird way, it almost seems like they're treating some of those issues as quaint. I don't know. How would you respond to that, Edward?
That's the first I've heard that complaint. I certainly hope that they don't sound like they're talking down to any kind of a region, if that's what the listener means by quaint. That would be awful. NPR does have a style, as we all know, that's kind of conversational and tries to be lighter and tries to find some humor in things, make stories interesting, etc. But I don't get a sense from the staff that there's any, concept of, we're the sophisticates and everybody else is a yokel, in part because almost the entire staff comes from different parts of the country. You know, they're not originally from Washington or New York. There's a great regional loyalty even within the staff.
Well, Edward, I've felt this some. You know, we sometimes think of ourselves as being perceived as flyover country by the coast, by California, by New York, by Washington.
Right, right.
And maybe what is a genuine interest in covering a local story, because we're maybe a little defensive to start with, it might sound, I don't know, condescending or like we're being covered as a novelty or quaint. So maybe a little bit's in the ear of the beholder.
That could be. That's a good point. That's a very good point. And it's so often when we hear stories about something that we know a lot about, we often feel that it's incomplete or not taken with the kind of weight that we might take a story. Not just something that's our particular region, but it may be what our industry is or whatever it is. No story is going to have the kind of depth that an expert or a resident that's living something will know, because it's oftentimes more than the rest of us want to know. But still, that said, it shouldn't be condescending.
Now, we've been joking a little bit about NPR relocating. I doubt that you're about to pull up stakes in Washington. And
just moved into a new building.
You just got a new building. All right, so that shoots that in the foot. But, I mean, do you have any other plans, even kind of just, thought experiments about branching NPR out, even with another satellite like you have in California?
Well, the California one is an interesting one, this NPR West. It has sort of grown and shrunk over the last 15 years. They've moved shows out there, discovered they became too Western, or for some reason they didn't work out. The shows moved back east, and now they're moving the weekend, all things considered, back to the West Coast, again to try to experiment to have more of that, at least more of a West Coast voice on NPR, not be too East Coast and especially Washington-centric. It's curious. It's an interesting thing about NPR West. One reason why they built up NPR West was that if some catastrophe should happen and the main headquarters should go down, they could shift production to the West Coast. But I don't know of any plans to move anything to the Midwest, which is a shame.
That's pretty dire. You were actually making plans should the entire NPR operation go down?
Well, you would hope they would if you think about it, right?
I guess so. That's planning for you, but yeah.
Maybe in the wake of 9/11, lots of people have thought about plans about what to do.
Well, and that's us here in the Midwest. Yeah. We were more removed than you were. It probably was more immediate.
Mm. Yeah.
So in talking to your colleagues over at NPR, is there a conversation going on about this, about how they can make sure they represent the rest of the country, coasts,
yeah,
and everybody else too?
Let me say that there is. Let me say there is a genuine interest, at least a genuine talking a good game about wanting to make sure they have a lot of regional voices on the air and reflect regional concerns. When I say by talking a good game, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. They really do make an honest effort to want to do it. Sometimes they just run up against that either budget restrictions or time restrictions. Maybe the time restrictions is the biggest one, because NPR in fact does have a large staff spread across the country. It has more than 20 bureaus. It's got a compared to any other national media, it actually has a bigger presence than almost anyone. And they do make an honest effort to bring to us what's happening in the rest of the country or how people feel on common national issues. And can they do a better job? Yeah, they can do a better job. And I think they know they can do a better job. And so the top editors are constantly pressing to keep those regional voices in there. And there's a vice president of diversity who's actually in the newsroom. He's not a corporate guy. He's actually inside the newsroom, whose job is not just to be involved in terms of hiring, but really in terms of coverage. And he sits right next to the senior vice president for news. It's something that's taken it serious inside the House, I'll say that. Whether or not you think it's doing a good enough job still is another question.
Now, how about the urban-rural divide? I mean, obviously on the East Coast, you've got a lot of big cities, L.A.
Right.
But even if we expand that to Chicago, Milwaukee, right, big cities, is there a chance we overlook everybody else outside the cities?
Yes, I think we do. There is a reporter in Utah who is the rural affairs reporter, and he writes about rural affairs across the country. But, that's one reporter doing that, dedicated specifically to doing rural affairs. There are many reporters who will do stories that are rural oriented, or for some reason, go out and do a story that's not in a big city. But even though we are increasingly an urban country, it behooves us to remember what's going on in small towns and in rural areas of the country.
All right, let's get him a quick call here. We have Laura with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I just have a short comment. I don't believe you have to make any change. I really like your program. I like the coverage that I receive about Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Madison, Wisconsin, or the surrounding cities. I like the coverage I receive about the USA. And I also like the coverage I receive from all over the world. I think you do a wonderful job.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a good reminder, actually. I mean, Laura, when people hear public radio here in Wisconsin, they're hearing your news from NPR, and they're hearing our news from Wisconsin Public Radio and our talk shows. And a lot of other stations have that local content to fit it in.
That's right. That's a good point. Gee, that was we should record that, and I'm sure
the pledge people will love that.
I'm sure the development office would love to replay that. No, but I mean I really appreciate Laura's comments on that, and at least it shows that someone sees the efforts that we're all making between the national and what you're doing in Wisconsin.
Well, so, Edward, we're getting close to the end of the hour here, about 30 seconds left, a little bit more than that. But tell us, do you feel vindicated now that you've delved into the numbers? You could say, you know what, we're doing okay.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, yes. I mean, it's nice to know that it's not so bad. But this is one where I think it is somewhat in the eyes of the holder. Everyone will decide for themselves whether or not they still think it's too much out of Washington or there's not enough coming from their part of the country or another part of the country. And so I put all the numbers out there for everyone to debate it and to talk and at least be aware of these issues.
Edward, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That was Edward Schumacher-Matos, Ombudsman for National Public Radio.
And coming up next, we'll talk to an expert about the Pope's comments earlier today about gay Catholics. And don't forget, you can keep up with us on the Central Time Facebook page. Weigh in on what you heard there. Maybe you want to weigh in on NPR and whether or not you like the coverage or you perceive a regional bias. Tell us what you think there. Or National Parks on the Moon, lots to comment on, lots of discussions to get involved in. And you can do that by checking out the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Durst. 10 children in Wisconsin have been rescued from child sex trafficking operations in a joint sweep that included both federal and state law enforcement agencies. Gelman Halstead reports.
The three-day operation was carried out by the FBI, Homeland Security, and 14 police and sheriff's departments in the state. In Wisconsin, police arrested 100 suspects, although not all of the charges filed were for sex trafficking. The 10 young people rescued in the state fit.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about how unlimited vacation could make you more productive. All right, I'm out of here.
I think you better stick around for a couple more hours.
A little bit longer.
Yeah, a little bit longer. Before that, though, we're going to be talking about the comments Pope Francis made earlier today about gay Catholics.
On the Pope's flight back from Rome to Rome from Brazil, he said he would not judge gay Catholics, including priests, as long as they have goodwill and search for the Lord, he said. Well, here to break down these comments for us and what they may mean for Catholics around the world is Wayne Thompson. He is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. Wayne, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the media certainly reacted to these comments. This is all over the news. How big a deal are they really, do you think?
Well, in terms of a shift in rhetoric, they might, they might indicate some real change coming from the Vatican and for the Roman Catholic Church. But in terms of institutional policies, probably I would not look for a lot of change there.
Right. This is just the Pope talking to reporters on a plane, not an official encyclical or a papal bull or anything with that sort of standing, right?
Well, no, but when the Pope speaks, people listen, mm-hmm. and the Catholic hierarchy is very media savvy, and so comments made on a plane, although, informal and lacking the authority of an encyclical or a pastoral letter might come from the bishops and so on, it still carries a lot of weight. I mean, obviously, you can see that blogosphere has lit up here now.
Now, these comments might be in line with what's going on here in the United States, a lot of trend toward acceptance of lesbians, gays here in the U.S., the Defense of Marriage Act, overturn in the Supreme Court, so on. But is this directed toward the rest of the world as much as it is us here in the U.S.?
Well, possibly not. That's a good point. The African Catholics in Africa, certainly the hierarchy there, the bishops and cardinals, probably also in Asia, may be less the audience for this kind of comment. It's North American and European Catholics that may be a little bit more the target audience for these comments.
Why is that?
Well, because in the general cultural climate does have an impact on the church, as much as the church on paper is a top-down decision-making apparatus or bureaucracy, the cultural climate does have an impact. And the cultural climate for sexuality issues, particularly those related to homosexuality, has been shifting considerably in North America and Europe toward greater tolerance. And that's that shift has occurred among Catholics at an even greater rate than for other parts of the population. I looked at a Pew survey from 2013 that said 71% of Catholics think homosexuality should be accepted. This is among American adults, mm-hmm. compared to 65% of mainline Protestants. By comparison, among white evangelical Protestants, 59% think homosexuality should be discouraged. So there are cultural changes in the United States among Catholics that are favorable toward greater tolerance toward homosexuality.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's a kind of a tension in the Catholic Church. I mean, it's inherently, in a way, a conservative institution built to maintain timeless values regardless of the vagaries of public opinion. And yet, there's probably a sense that they don't want to be seen as completely out of touch with their parishioners, at least in certain countries. How do they resolve that?
Well, the Catholic Church through the ages has had a kind of organizational savvy or even genius for changing just enough at the right times. I'm thinking here about Vatican II that occurred in the 1960s into the 1970s, where the church engaged in, the Italian word is aggiornamento, which really means an updating of the church. Vatican II is a good example of that kind of incremental change where the church changes just a little bit at the right times. It is inherently a conservative institution, religion is in general, because they base authority in an earlier era. So that's to be expected. But there still is updating that goes on. And I think that the comments of Pope Francis indicating greater empathy toward homosexual identity among priests and for Catholic laity who may be LGBTQ persons, that should be viewed in that light. There is a history of the Catholic Church updating just enough at the to keep up with the times, if you will.
But not everyone was happy at the time with Vatican II, thinking it went too far. And with announcements like this from the Pope, is there a risk of alienating maybe more conservative members of the church, whether here or in places like Africa and Latin America?
Well, it's true. That yes, in certain parts of the, if you view Catholicism as a global religion, yes, that's true. Here in North America, though, these comments are probably going to be mostly well-received, although there is this distinction between traditionalist Catholics and what some people call cafeteria-style Catholics, or those that are more accommodating, more accepting of cultural relativism. But keep in mind, the Pew Forum poll shows 71% of Catholics believe, and this is a 2013 poll, that our society should be more accepting of homosexuality. That is a sea change that's gone on in our culture especially over the last decade. Catholics aren't immune from that. The Pope's well aware of that when he made those comments.
You mentioned earlier that this really lit up the blogosphere among Catholics and the media in general. One of the themes, the threads I've been seeing is, hey, this is yet another example of Pope Francis reaching out to marginalized groups. Do you think that's a trend in his papacy so far?
Well, yes, it is. And you have to understand that Roman Catholic hierarchy is trying to get off of the sexuality issues, and so that they can get more attention to the kinds of issues that the Catholic bishops are pushing, which would include a preferential option for the poor, the selection of Pope Francis as Pope has to be viewed in that light as well. So if they're going to get a louder megaphone, if you will, in for the church, then they have to get the subject off the sexuality issues. Now, so you could say that this does not move them in that direction, but in a way it does, because it once they've indicated greater tolerance, they can tie it into the theme of preferential option for the poor and other kinds of issues, talking to marginalized groups. So I think that the Pope Francis has struck a theme of greater tolerance and understanding of marginalized groups.
Before I let you go, I wanted to talk to you about the style of the new pope. We just saw him out from behind bodyguards and bulletproof glass and in crowds in Rio. He's just kind of shooting the breeze with reporters for 80 minutes on a plane. This is a different kind of pope than we're used to, isn't it?
And perhaps different than what was expected when he was selected. The Vatican's a bit of a black box in terms of finding out what the inner discourse in the inner sanctum is. But the selection of Pope Francis was expected to be a placemaker that is not a celebrity pope. He may be breaking out of that mold under the force of his own personality and because of that contact and comfort with the masses.
Wayne, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Coming up next, we'll talk about how unlimited vacation could do more than just be a lot of fun. It could boost your productivity. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, we're in the middle of a lovely Wisconsin summer, and lots of us are probably pining to get out of the office and take advantage of the weather.
It is hard, though. We've got a limited number of vacation days. We all might be trying to bank them for when we really need the time off.
Well, a recent trend in the workplace is to give employees unlimited vacation. And here to talk with us about that is Lydia Dishman, a business journalist and regular contributor to Fast Company. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for a lot of us, the phrase unlimited vacation does not compute. What does that mean?
Oh, that's basically just tossing the two-week standard policy that a lot of companies use in favor of just giving people the freedom to choose their own length of vacation.
So the sky's the limit? I could take off 3 months if I got my job done?
Essentially, yes, but a lot of companies are finding that people stick pretty closely to that 2 or 3 week limit anyway.
So it sounds kind of like employee heaven. How does it seem to go over when companies start doing it?
Well, it varies, but as I said, a lot of companies are finding that when they toss out the 2 week standard, that a lot of people are sticking close to it. Even in such industries as healthcare, you might not think that would be something that would stray too far from that norm, but a company called Audax Health tossed out that standard and then conducted a survey with their employees and found that 95% of the 100 employees were very satisfied with unlimited vacation. No surprise there. They also get unlimited sick days. So while they have no hard data, Audax Health has found on average that most of their employees take between 2 and 3 weeks. Vacations.
So is unlimited vacation and in some cases unlimited sick time, is this being implemented in places where people, the culture is to work till you drop pretty much, and this is a way of kind of easing the tension?
Well, there is definitely some of that in startups where people do tend to work round the clock, especially engineers that are getting ready to deliver new products. And Dharmesh Shah, who is the co-founder of HubSpot, said he doesn't track vacations, but he definitely does find himself working late at night. Laura Fitton, who actually started at HubSpot, she says that the last time she took a vacation day was when her child was sick, so it was hardly a day at the beach.
Well, a study you looked at showed that something like, I think it was 12% of participants feel guilty that they're not at work when they're on vacation. Does something like unlimited vacation take care of the guilt? You sort of feel like, well, I guess it's okay.
Part of that is true. Some people do feel like, you know, they can completely unplug, but other people find that they need to continue checking in One of the women that I interviewed, Sharon Rosenblatt, said that while she was on vacation, she found herself writing part of a federal proposal response while she was stuck in traffic because the client extended service into her vacation time.
Wow. Well, can you tell me something about the places where this is being implemented? I guess give me a sense of how widespread it is so far.
Well, it's, as I said, a lot of different types of companies from, you know, anywhere from healthcare, large healthcare companies to startups. I have one anecdote from Braintree, which is a global payment platform that has clients such as Airbnb and Living Social and OpenTable. And they say that not having a policy works really well, that, you know, they treat everybody like adults, and they use Parkinson's Law as much as possible. And if you're not familiar with that, it's basically the amount of time which one has to perform a task is the amount of time it will take to complete that task. So they try to be as efficient as possible. But Braintree, is just one example of a different type of company that's using the no vacation policy. Another is Motley Fool, which is a 17-year-old company. And they actually send people on vacation when they feel like they need it. They send them on a two-week, what they call a fool's errand, and, force them out the door and tell them not to come back until 2 weeks is up.
That sounds okay. Now, are all of these companies in the Bay Area? Does anyone in Wisconsin, for instance, or the Midwest do this?
Well, I don't know about Wisconsin, but I know that, these companies are not all in the Bay Area, definitely. Motley Fool is based just outside of Washington, D.C., so you definitely have people, across the country that are tapping into this plan.
So in terms of productivity, what are employers seeing when they implement unlimited vacation?
Well, I think an honor system really does speak to the best of people. I think when they feel like they are responsible for their own work and that somebody isn't looking over their shoulder and they're not clocking in and out, that they actually will do the right thing and, get their work done on time, in some cases even earlier.
Hmm. So it has a potential, and we're seeing that it does boost productivity.
Absolutely.
So there's a good reason for doing it. What are reasons do you think that some companies aren't doing it?
Well, I think that probably, companies that have had that standard policy in effect for, decades might not want to step outside of the box and, allow a lot of people to just take unlimited time off. I think that, larger companies, especially, when you get up to 1,000-plus employees, it's a little difficult to keep tabs on everybody. But I think it definitely can work for a lot of different types of companies if you have a decent system in place to communicate exactly what's expected when people are taking vacation. You can't just, say one day, hey, I'm taking off, and, then pull the plug and come back 2 weeks later. I think it's, communicating is really important before you go.
In terms of how people relate to one another inside an office environment, inside a workplace, does having unlimited vacation, do you think, change the dynamic at all?
I think that it definitely could. I think it will encourage people to really think about their own role and how that affects other people that they work with, either directly or indirectly. I think that, as I said before, communicating is really important. So if you're planning to take a two-week solid vacation and completely unplug, it is really important to communicate that well beforehand and let everybody know what you're working on so that everyone can work around you while you're not there.
And if one person, say, were to really run with the idea of unlimited vacation and say, I'm going to take a month in Hawaii, whereas Bob in the cubicle next door says, well, for me, unlimited means 2 or 3 weeks, there could be sort of tensions there, I can imagine. I suppose people kind of have to be on the same page about what unlimited vacation means.
Yes, and I think that that's where, managers can sit down with their staff and communicate exactly what is expected. A month off might be perfectly fine if you've, say, just delivered a new product or service, or you've reached a major deadline. Then it's time to exhale and regroup and tap into your creative and innovative channels again, so that might be exactly perfect. While you're in the middle of some major project, though, that might not be such a good time. But I think the important thing is for everyone to sit down and talk about what their goals are and realistically talk about what they're looking at when they do choose to take time away from the office.
Do you think this is part of an effort to redesign office culture?
I certainly think so, and I think it's kind of an extension of telecommuting. You know, when more and more people started telecommuting and you don't have a boss trolling the halls or looking over your shoulder while you're sitting in your cubicle, it does give people a certain amount of responsibility that they have to place on themselves to get that work done, not necessarily between the hours of 9 to 5. So I think that the unlimited vacation is just sort of a natural outgrowth of that phenomenon where, you know, people are taking more and more responsibility for what they deliver, as it should be. And, you know, it doesn't really matter if they, you know, spend an hour in the morning looking at a beautiful sunrise as long as they are, you know, meeting their deadline by, say, 3 o'clock, if that's what's called for.
Well, you may have seen this piece. Last year, Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote a pretty widely read Atlanta column saying that women really can't have it all unless they have the ability to make their own schedules. Do you see this as a step in that direction at all?
Yes, I think it is definitely a step in that direction. But, you know, when I interviewed Laura Fitton, as she said, she took a vacation day just to deal with a sick child. So we definitely, as women, are playing a juggling act, especially if we have children at home and, you know, are the primary caregiver. But I think that, you know, again, the responsibility that you place on yourself trumps everything. And so, you know, it's up to you to strike that balance of, you know, your time off and your time in the office or spent working wherever that office might be.
Now, you probably talked to some folks and got a sense of how it was going over there. And we've got about a minute left. But do you think this is something that's going to stick around and catch on and spread?
Absolutely. I think that the people that have implemented it have had a great deal of success, and certainly, you know, the more that people understand that it can be done and that, you know, people aren't just, you know, stepping away and, you know, going packing their suitcase and never coming back is really not a reality. That, you know, people do have to work and they will come back, but they are very appreciative of the fact that a company trusts them enough, their manager or their supervisor trusts them enough to go off and then come back recharged and ready to face new challenges.
All right. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Lydia Dishman, business journalist and regular contributor to Fast Company.
So what do you think about this unlimited vacation idea? Is it something you'd like to see at your workplace? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Or if you own a business, is this something you would consider doing? An honor system, unlimited vacation? Central Time Facebook page. Love to see what you think.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out the Experimental Aviation Association's annual Air Venture. It's coming up in Oshkosh this week.
Then we'll discuss a new Frontline report about the state of for-profit assisted living homes.
And we'll hear about more extroversion and how it might make you happier.
That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.